I'm a heat and humidity dissenter. So thanks to air conditioning's inventor. Using a fan can make me chagrined, because the answer isn't always blowing in the wind. And that, my friends, just one of the many hits of Peter, Paul, and Mary. Blowing in the wind, that is. The Peter of which is on this week's show. He's back in West Wisconsin. We last talked 7 years ago when he visited Chippewa Falls. This time, Peter Yarrow is in luck. A second show has been added at the West Denmark Lutheran Church. Looking forward to sharing our conversation. I just bought their 25 greatest hits and am having the time of my life. Catherine Thomas returns with news of a visit to the Great River Shakespeare Festival in Winona, Minnesota, where she visited with actor Alex Gibbons, who has a total of 3 current roles, 2 in Cymbeline, 1 in Macbeth. He's a bright young man with an acting future to match. And we begin this week by telling you that we're very near the start of the very first Red Cedar Film Festival coming to Menominee, the culmination of a couple years of thoughtful planning. Anna McCabe manages professional education programs and services at UW Stout, and the festival fits in the program's category. Anna and I spent some time on the phone recently getting what we all needed to know. A quick refresher, if you would, please, on how this all began. What's the partnership?
Well, Peter Galante is a professor at UW Stout, and he's been talking about wanting to do a film festival in Menominee for several years. Being a film producer as well, he just knows the industry really well, and he has always believed that Menominee would be a great location. So our office, the Professional Education Programs and Services, putting on non-credit outreach courses, sessions. It was just a good fit to kind of partner with Peter and try and make something like this happen.
How long was it in the works?
It's very interesting because Peter was giving a talk on the potential for a film festival in Menominee in October 2016. I had never met him before. It just kind of was happenstance that I was in that session, and I told him, you know, if you really want to make this happen, we can do it. He didn't know who I was. I didn't really formally introduce myself or my office and what we do. But then it wasn't until 2017, when the new school year is happening, we have a lot of, you know, professional development on campus.
Mm-hmm.
So people just come to, you know, the Stout sessions that are gearing up for the new school year, just talking about, you know, different things internally for, you know, just kind of building morale, what have you, at Stout. And so I was in a session with Peter, a workshop session in September 2017. So I kind of reintroduced myself and said, hey, so you had talked about this film festival, and if you're ever really interested in that, my office can help put it on. And I think it was just maybe the perfect time and place to try and really get the ball rolling. So since, you know, September 2017, we've been talking about this for 2019.
Okay. Yeah. Well, it's never easy to put a film festival together, but it does get easier the more years you're involved because, as we all know, you make connections, and if the festival is good enough, people come to you and want to be part of it. But putting a first one on, that's probably the most difficult because you're new at it. Talk about that process.
It's been pretty difficult getting people to want to buy tickets.
Sure.
That's difficult. You know, there could be a lot of people in this region that aren't familiar with film festivals. If they've maybe never gone to see an independent film, then this might be out of their wheelhouse. So trying to explain what this is and, you know, that we have it, you know, very local here in Menominee, and really cool independent films will be screened at the Maple Tanner, which is just a beautiful theater.
Mm-hmm.
Just trying to get the buy-in, I guess. But, I mean, we had so many filmmakers submit films. We didn't have any difficulty there.
Okay.
That was awesome.
That's the part I thought would be the most difficult.
Actually, it hasn't been, because there's this submission portal called Film Freeway that all filmmakers use to submit films for film festivals.
Okay.
So it's a very known, you know, film submission portal. They just look 4 film festivals to have their films screened.
And independent films used to be a title that people shied away from, but there have been so many independent films that have ended up making it big, and independent filmmakers are some of the most interesting people around. To say independent films is actually a draw nowadays.
Well, I hope so. I believe it is. Yeah. I hope so. Yeah. No, absolutely. And the passion that the filmmakers have, it's so awesome to hear them talk about, you know, the story of the film and, you know, how they started working on it and, you know, everything that goes into it. Also, just to hopefully, you know, gain a lot of that, you know, respect and, you know, draw for kind of this more underground. And in some cases, we even have more local films, which is very cool, too.
Yeah, that is cool. In some promos, I said you guys are preparing the popcorn. Is that true?
I hope so.
Good. Okay.
So the Mabel Tanner, I think we are planning to have popcorn.
Okay, good. Because you can't watch a movie without popcorn.
No, exactly. I agree completely. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Talking with Anna McCabe, Program Manager for Professional Education Programs and Services at UW-Stout. They're a partner in the first Red Cedar Film Festival beginning next week. The official dates, July 24th through 28th. The dates actually reflect an opening gala on the evening of the 24th. That is in a brew pub, yes?
Yes, the Brunonic here in Menominee.
Okay.
So the opening gala, we would definitely welcome anybody who wants to be a part of the film festival and buy a VIP pass.
Okay.
We have the opening gala and then the closing brunch on July 28th, available to any VIP film pass holders, as well as all of the filmmakers, you know, the teams involved with the films.
Uh-huh. And between the 24th and 28th, there are films being shown the 25th, 26th, and 27th. Tell us the venues. I know the Mabel Tanner is one. You're going to be in a band shell too, right?
Correct. So we will predominantly be at the Mabel Tanner, but Saturday night, July 27th, we will have films screened outside at Wilson Park in the band shell.
All right. And how many films do you have totally?
Oh, gosh. We have a lot.
That's good enough.
A lot of them are short films. You know, for instance, 5 p.m. on Thursday, there are 6 films being shown during that time frame. It's a total of 51 minutes, but there will be 6 films during that time. And so we have a couple different sessions like that where, you know, we do have quite a few shorts.
All right. And also within that time span, there is an awards program.
That is Friday, July 26th. You know, we'll have some refreshments there and all of the filmmakers. So that is also definitely for the VIP pass holders.
Oh, okay. Who are the judges?
Peter Galante, the film professor and the mastermind and founder of this festival, as well as some other professors, and Rick Vacious, the founder of the Flyaway Film Festival in Pepin.
Mm-hmm.
And then Kevin Pontutti, really involved, has done quite a few films, produced films, directed films, kind of locally, and then he's actually working with Peter Galante on shooting the film right now in Ireland.
Do you gather, and do the film producers care about the opinions of the people seeing the films? Is there a way that you gather information from them as to how much they liked it?
Yeah, we've talked about having an evaluation form, or if we can try and encourage that via social media, because we do have a Red Cedar Film Festival Facebook page as well as an Instagram account.
Okay.
We'd love to hear what people are saying or, you know, thinking about the films. You know, definitely review them on social media too. I think that would be a great platform.
Film producers are always interested in what the audience is thinking. They better be.
Yes, absolutely.
All right. We have disseminated a lot of information. How do we attend? I know there's a website. It's redcedarfilm.org. And you've mentioned the VIP category. How do us regular folks attend?
Sure. So you can definitely buy, you know, a pass just for one session. If you want to come to one film, that's $10. Otherwise, you can buy a film festival pass, which is $40, and you can come and see all of the films. And then the VIP pass, which will get you into the gala and the award social, as well as the closing brunch, that's $80.
Sounds reasonable to me for all that you're getting.
Absolutely, for sure.
And the smell of popcorn.
Yes, and these great independent films and being a part of the filmmakers, the film producers, the film teams should be there for a lot of these films, getting to meet them and hear about their film and, you know, the whole process of creating these independent films, I think, will be really cool for the film goers.
What you already know about having put together this first festival, are you already planning a second, or are you going to wait to see how the first goes?
We are planning a second. hoping to have that the very last weekend of July going into August. Mm. Some people here were wondering if we could schedule it not during the Dunn County Fair, even though trying to pull from different segments of the local population can be tricky. So I think we're looking to have it like maybe the very first weekend of August next mm-hmm. summer.
Do you have a booth at the Dunn County Fair?
We don't. We're going to be so busy with the film festival that unfortunately I don't know that we'll be able to promote it during the Dunn County Fair, but maybe we can somehow get passes out to some people for prizes.
You should hire somebody to walk around the Dunn County Fair handing out brochures, because it wouldn't matter to the fairgoers. The fair officials would say, well, they're handing it out to people who are already at the fair, so they're not keeping them away.
Absolutely. That's a good point.
Work together. That's what it's all
about. Absolutely, yes. A Menominee captive audience. Why not try and make the best of it?
You bet. Anna McCabe, thanks. As always, you're full of information. The Red Cedar Film Festival is going to be fun. Thank you.
Yes, thank you, Al.
And lots of good luck to the organizers of the first Red Cedar Film Festival. A chat with Peter Yarrow prior to evening and afternoon concerts in Luck, Wisconsin next weekend. And a young actor hones his skills in summer theater next on Spectrum West. Support for WPR comes from the Great River Shakespeare Festival in Winona, now through August 4th, with White Rabbit, Red Rabbit, where the actor has never seen the script and everyone must learn to keep a secret. GRSF.org. Support also comes from Charter Bank of Eau Claire, a locally owned community bank, now offering new checking account options with personalized customer service. More information available at charterbankec.org. Bank. Well, this week, contributor Catherine Thomas brings us an insider's look at the Great River Shakespeare Festival in the middle of its 16th season on the campus of Winona State University. She visited and sat down with actor Alex Givens, a recent University of North Carolina MFA recipient, headed to New York after his Minnesota summer. He plays a double role in Shakespeare's rather obscure Cymbeline, as well as portraying Malcolm in Macbeth. So let's go backstage with Catherine and Alex.
Cymbeline is not as well known as a lot of Shakespeare's other plays, like Macbeth. Were you familiar with it before you worked on this particular production? And did you have any reaction when you first heard that this was one of the plays for this season?
Yeah, I was not at all familiar with it, really, before being told about the production. For me, I know that it is one of the few great roles that Shakespeare wrote for women. Imogen, the leading lady of the show, is Imogen, and it's one of the great Shakespearean roles for women. They're not a lot in the canon for women, but that is one of the really, really great ones. So I knew about Imogen and the character, so I've heard of the play, but I've never read it. My idea as to why it's a lesser-known play and maybe not produced as much is because it's a tricky play to put on because of the themes that it deals with, because of the way that the text moves, the way it kind of works. He wrote it towards the end of his career. So I think that Shakespeare was a little bit, he wrote more simply, but he also wrote more closely to the way that the human mind experiences things. He wrote even closer to the human experience. So, you know, logic is not as easy to use in terms of interpreting this play. Working on this play, I've realized that humans don't think logically. Our thoughts are illogical, and we use logic as a filter in which to make sense of what we think or what we experience. And I've only realized this after working on the play for months and months and hours and hours and hours. That's part of what makes this play one of the lesser-known plays and one of the lesser-produced plays, because it's a little tricky to get right, I think.
Whoever makes the decisions about which plays you're going to do, why do you think they chose it now?
Oh, that's a really great question. I think the why now for this play is, I mean, right now our country and our society is wrestling with and having conversations about a number of things that this play touches on, one of the biggest ones being gender roles and a woman's experience. There's a lot of things talking about worth and a woman's worth in the play. There's chastity, there's honor, all these virtues that women are supposed to have that society says that they should. I think that this play is really, really great in terms of dealing with that. I think our character Imogen is a great, I guess, case study or great lesson in the ways in which women, fit and break the mold in terms of how we think they should behave or how we think that they should act. And in the same hand, it looks at that for men too, the ways in which we view ourselves and the way we view ourselves in relation to women. I think that all of those things are really, really big things right now in our society. I think it deals with status. What are things that we can and can't do because of the status that we have? How are we supposed to behave? Again, just like with gender roles, it deals with social status, socioeconomic status, all of these things. Those are kind of the big why nows of the play, for me at least.
Why don't we talk about what the play is about? What is the plot of Cymbeline?
The major plot is Imogen is the daughter to the king, whose name is Cymbeline. She has grown up with this boy in the court. His name is Posthumus, my character. His parents died before he was born, but because his father was a great military general, the king took in my character Posthumus and trained me up and bred me as a gentleman of the court. So Posthumus and Imogen have grown up together, become friends, but Posthumus is still very low status in comparison to Imogen. At the top of the play, Posthumus and Imogen get married unbeknownst to the king. And the king doesn't like that. So the king curses Posthumus out a lot. He's very, very unhappy with him. There's nothing to be gained from that marriage. The king wants to use his daughter for political expedience and other things of that nature. Posthumus can't offer that. So he banishes Posthumus to Rome. And throughout the play, Posthumus is duped into believing that Imogen has been false to him. So Posthumus basically tries to have her murdered. She's not a chaste woman, and she's, you know, she's been false to him and all of these things. Whereas Imogen has no idea of that someone's lied to Posthumus about this. And so when she finds out that her husband wants to have her killed, she obviously goes through her own journey. So yes, all of these things happen. Sorry, I'm trying to like keep it all together for one main plot. But the next big thing that happens is that we follow both of these characters in their journeys to try to make it back to each other and make sense of what has happened and what has gone on. They both think that each other has died before the end of the play, so they both think that they're without each other for the rest of their lives. And as Shakespeare typically happens in more of a comedy style instead of a tragedy, which is what this play has been dubbed, a tragedy, towards the end of the play we find out that all of it was a big hoax and that there was one person who lied to both Posthumus and Imogen that caused the whole thing to happen. And we have a bunch of different reunions of family, of lovers, of friends, all of that at the end of the play.
So what I've read about the plot and what you've said, Shakespeare did use a lot of plot devices that were common throughout some of his other plays. Mm-hmm. I thought you were dead, but you weren't really dead. Father-daughter relationships.
A woman dressing in men's clothes to go undercover and try to figure out information. That's very much like, you know, Twelfth Night. Yeah, you have a character tricking another character that his wife has been false to his bed, and that's more of the Othello kind of vein of things. So yeah, it's a huge amalgamation of a lot of different roles that I think makes it so fun.
What makes it distinct from the plays that it shares plot points with?
Oh, that's a really great question. I think for me, one of the big things that I've thought about that makes it so different from a lot of the other plays that we've talked about, one would be the fact that this play, it takes place, it's set in 0 AD. It's the year Jesus is born. And so in that sense, we like to think dramaturgically that he's dealing somewhat with the idea of grace versus the idea of justice. So in the beginning of the play, and a lot throughout the first half of the play, we deal with these acts that are just, but are not graceful. We act out of wrath and not out of love and compassion. And so I think that one of the big things that makes this play different, it poses the question, what happens when justice doesn't seem quite right? So Posthumus, I'll speak for my own character, asks for his wife to be killed because back in those days, and unfortunately in today's society, a lot of people think that when they're cheated on, that means that their partner should be punished severely. In Posthumus's mind, that actually happens. He thinks that his wife has been killed, and he's the one who's ordered the hit. Now, that's justice in his mind. He thinks that that's justice. But once it happens, we have a number of scenes where Posthumus is wondering why things don't feel right. Why does the world not make sense? This is how the world has always been. It's kind of the, and not to get too biblical, but it's the Old Testament versus New Testament. I did exactly what I was supposed to do and punish that person who did me wrong. Why does it still feel like I haven't healed myself or I don't feel better. And so we get into the question of grace and understanding that you don't have to live in a world of fear anymore because there's grace for everyone. Grace abounds. Forgiveness is there. Retribution is there. That's the huge difference, I believe, with this play. And with that, in a lot of ways, we come back from a lot of the things that people in the other plays don't. So Othello, you know, when he's tricked to believe Desdemona has been false to him, I mean, he kills her and he winds up dead. I mean, everyone winds up dead. In our play, that doesn't happen. Not even the person who went around doing all of the trickery. Iacomo is his name, which, again, sounds familiar to Iago in Othello. But in our play, Iacomo is the one who kind of enacts a lot of the tricking and making everyone want to kill other people and all these things. And he even winds up being forgiven. There's forgiveness throughout the play. And I think that that's been the really, really fun and meaty piece of this play.
Let's get to your characters. So you play two characters in Cymbeline, Posthumus mm-hmm. and Cloten. Mm-hmm. Is it usual for an actor to have two different roles?
Yeah, it is very, very common for an actor to play more than one role in a Shakespeare play. Shakespeare wrote close to what real experience is. His plays have 20 or 30 characters because, you know, just in today, you might meet 20 or 30 people, whether you realize it or not, or have an exchange of some sort with 20 or 30 people. So a lot of his plays have upwards of 20 characters, but you have a cast of maybe 9. I think our cast has 9. Each one of us plays 2, if not 3 roles. So it's very common.
You talked with someone from the Winona Post not too long ago, and you noted that this production of Cymbeline is the first time that Great River Shakespeare Festival has a predominantly black cast. Your feelings about that?
Yeah. I'm very, very proud of that and excited about that because, you know, we're sitting here talking about the human experience. And so I think it's important to have humans on stage. Whatever that might actually mean, it's important to have humans on stage, regardless of color, regardless of ability, regardless of access or lack thereof that they may have to carry out these roles, regardless of, you know, sexuality, gender, religion, everything. I think it's important that we continue to try to break the traditional view that certain types of people speak Shakespeare and that certain types of people look like Shakespearean actors and that certain types of people sound like Shakespearean actors, because then we fall back into that trap that arts in general, not just theater, but art in general has always kind of suffered from as an institution, is that it's always seen as the cultural elite. And in our society right now, we understand that the cultural elite are predominantly white. And I think that it's important that we have people of color and people of different body types on the stage. So I'm very proud that this company is thinking about that, has their eye on that, and that they also understand that we do our work. We come in, we do the same great bang-up job that everyone else does, and we have fun while doing it. I'm really, really proud of that and really excited about that.
You've been doing the shows for a couple weeks now since late June. How do you think audiences are responding?
I don't think I'm being too generous in saying it just seems like every night, Cymbeline specifically, is a great kind of experience for all the things that happen. And it is a roller coaster, man. We were at lows really quickly and we were at highs the very next second. I mean, it moves differently and the audience tells us what's funny. So this is the first time I've really been a part of a play where each night the laughs come at different places. And as theater practitioners, we know how to craft moments to get laughs. We know about timing, comedic timing, and all of these things, and we can anticipate a little bit. But this is the first show that I've worked on that every single night it is completely different. And the audience tells us what they think is incredibly profound and what they think is incredibly hilarious. This play, it doesn't live in either place. It's neither incredibly reverent and profound, nor is it incredibly comedic the entire way through. It bounces between, you know, reverent and serious and true and incredibly absurd and funny and hilarious. The great realizations and the great catharsis at the end, I think that's how it all has to be for us to get to those places. If you don't get the temperatures just right each scene, it can be a runaway train in terms of everything being kind of like stuck in one tone of seriousness, or it can be like, oh, we've turned it into a comedy and now everything is hilarious. It lives back and forth, and that's what I like so much about it.
You know, I wasn't sure if anyone would be available to talk to me today, the day of two performances, almost back to back, because I don't know what it's like for you before a show. Angst-ridden, tortured artist. I don't know. That's what I was picturing, but you're so relaxed and smiley. That's cool. That's just another surprise for me. But it's a lot of work doing these two performances for over a month here at the Great River Shakespeare Festival. How do you keep up your stamina over that period of time?
Well, thank you. I try my best to stay as even keel as possible. So, yeah, two show days are quite a ride. I enjoy it. I think what's important stamina-wise is pacing yourself, really. Understanding the night before you have a two-show day, so, okay, maybe I should go to bed a little bit earlier. Or, you know, doing whatever I need to do to feel ready for what I have to do. But also compartmentalizing. This is the very nature of acting in a lot of ways in terms of how to act. You have to compartmentalize how you feel. You have to say, I can only worry about this one thing right now. I can only worry about this one scene. I'm so exhausted. But if I can just stay focused on this one thing for the next 10 minutes on stage, I can go off stage and take a break and come back and keep working. But also being here at the festival, thankfully, having come back a number of years, I know exactly how the season moves. I get the way the roller coaster kind of goes. And so I know how to kind of dole out my energy and save my energy when I need to. It's also helpful to have just finished an MFA. If you want exhaustion, do an MFA in the theater because it is very, very tiring. And so I feel like I can handle a season where I do two different roles. And, you know, different actors have different workloads, and we all try to just be gracious. Again, be kind with one another, be kind to yourself. Understand that we all are in the same part of the summer, so we're all exhausted, we're all happy to be doing the work. And it's hard to work in the theater. It's hard to find jobs sometimes as an actor. And so you understand that when you're in the room, you're excited to be in the room. You're happy to be in the room. You do so much waiting in this industry. You're waiting for people to tell you it's okay to audition, or that you can do the role, or that you can do whatever. So, you know, when the stage manager says places, you don't have to wait anymore. They're giving you the green light to go out there and have as much fun as you possibly can for an hour or 2 hours or 2.5 hours. And so with that thought, I can always smile and always feel like, you know, this is going to be great. This is what I'm here for. I'm here to have fun and play make-believe for 2 hours. So yeah, I'm pretty happy about it. I'm pretty excited. You don't find too many problems with me from doing a two-show day with these kind of shows and these kind of actors.
Alex Givens, thanks so much.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
And thank you, Catherine. Peter Yarrow returns to West Wisconsin, filling up first shows and requiring second ones. He'll open himself up, as he always does, next on Spectrum West. But first, here's Jim Oliver with what's on stage in West Wisconsin.
Thank you, sir. The Eau Claire Children's Theater will present Snow White, the first in this summer series of For Kids by Kids, today, which you're listening on Thursday, and Friday in the Oxford Theater. Weekend comedy will be performed through July the 28th on Fridays and Saturdays at 7:30 p.m., as well as Sundays at 2:30 p.m. in the Phipps Center for the Arts in Hudson. Fools by Neil Simon, a festival theater production, will play Saturdays and Sundays through August 4th in the Franklin Square Black Box Theater in St. Croix Falls. The musical Oliver will be presented through Sunday in the Heidi Center for the Arts in Chippewa Falls. The Red Barn Theater of Rice Lake is presenting Mamma Mia. The show will continue through Saturday. The Little Mermaid is being presented Friday and Saturday in the St. Croix Art Barn in Osceola. And the Old Gem Theater of New Richmond will present its version of The Little Mermaid Thursday and Friday, July the 25th and 26th, and Saturday, July the 27th at 10:30 a.m. Saving a Ghost Town, an original play by Peyton Anderson, will be presented by Theater in the Woods in Shell Lake. The show will continue Friday and Saturday evenings, August the 2nd and 3rd, and Sunday afternoon, August the 4th. And the Chippewa Valley Theater Guild has scheduled auditions for the musical Tommy at 7 p.m. Monday and Tuesday, July the 29th and 30th, in the Grand Theater in Eau Claire.
Thank you, sir. Support for WPR comes from Charter Bank of Eau Claire, a locally owned community bank now offering new checking account options with personalized customer service. More information available at charterbankec.bank. Support also comes from ArtZ Gallery with Observations of Imagination, showing found object assemblage by David Smith, landscape paintings by Megan Schmidt, and silver and stone jewelry by Brenda Hack. ArtZGallery.org.
Lemon tree, very pretty, and the lemon flower is sweet, but the fruit of the poor lemon is impossible to eat.
If I had a hammer, I'd a hammer in the morning, I'd a hammer in the evening over this land.
Where have all the flowers gone? Long time passing.
This land is your land.
Mr. Peter Yarrow is returning to West Wisconsin. The first name of Peter, Paul, and Mary fame brings his music to the West Denmark Lutheran Church in Luck, Wisconsin for Saturday evening and Sunday afternoon concerts next weekend. To celebrate his return, I sent for the book, Peter, Paul, and Mary, 50 Years in Music and Life. And that's where our new conversation begins. I had to say after looking through it, and obviously you had to say after compiling stuff for it, what a life you've had.
Oh, absolutely. It was a really remarkable excursion in terms of remembering and thinking about and then writing about. I wrote almost all of the copy. I really thought this was the opportunity to tell our story from a personal, inside-out vantage point. It's really about what we shared, what we felt, and what we experienced, and how it shaped us. And I felt that it was a huge job. I wrote about 20 times what was ultimately used, because mm-hmm. I just would sit down and let it flow, and then I'd work with the editor to determine which portions would be best to include. But Peter, Paul, Mary really has become, for me, because it's almost 10 years since we performed together, really something to continue in spirit and in person. When I sing, and Noel and I do concerts with some frequency now, and I generally say, Noel, by the way, for those of you who are listening, is Paul of Peter, Paul, and Mary. We really feel as if Mary is inside ourselves, is embodied in our spirit when we sing the songs. And people agree with that. Oh, my goodness, I felt as if I was actually listening to Mary singing, too. Mm-hmm. But I think even more important than that observation is the fact that in this time, the spirit of the songs and the commitment to a particular vision for the world has become ever more critical and ever more important. It's so much of what we have worked towards, or we worked towards, is in direct contradiction to the direction that the world is going in many, many, many spots, with the strongmen emerging in Hungary and Italy, not just in the Philippines and of Russia, and in our own country. The essence of what we shared was that we were looking for a way to help create a world of fairness and love and beauty. And the inverse of that, taking hold now, and threatens not only all of us and democracy, but also the planet. That is a world run by and dominated by the power of fear. And when people are afraid, they are immobilized. It's elementary psychology. When you're on the bottom rung of Maslow's hierarchy of human needs, and that need is to survive, you're unable to address and integrate yourself as a human being into actualization on the levels of compassion and caring and sensitivity. You're just flummoxed. You're going to do what you can to survive. And in that state, you will allow egregious things to happen, and you will do egregious things. We are at a crossroads, and whenever I sing, and this will be the case when I come to be with you in your neck of the wood again, it turns into a very very special kind of gathering whereby people are all of a sudden reasserting something within themselves that has been inside, but to a certain degree occluded or covered by the environment that's so confusing and so threatening and so chaotic that they have little time to reassert their sense of unanimity, their sense of goodness, their sense of gratitude for each other, and transcend this divide that has afflicted us and made us really, really vulnerable. To live for a few hours in a sense that kind of clears the deck mm-hmm. and says, hey, we still have this goodness inside of us. We are strong when we are together is a very powerful moment. I mean, it's not changing the world, but it is affecting those people who are there at that time.
I grabbed a very brief quote in the conversation that you and I shared back in the fall of 2012.
Yeah.
The humanizing reality of the sharing of folk music. And I really like that quote. Here's my observation. I think we need the humanizing influence of folk music. Do we not write protest songs anymore? And if people are writing them, I'm not hearing them. Because we don't care, because there's a lot of social upheaval to be sung about. And instead, do we let the media named social do the work? You talked a lot about, in our last conversation, the positive influence of the internet, but it has shifted.
It has shifted enormously. And you've asked the right question, as always. First of all, folk music is really needed now, or music of that spirit, which folk music as a pure form, of course, doesn't exist anymore. So you don't have pure folk music, but what ultimately folk music means today is music that's been written from the heart, that somehow reveals honesty, that's deep within one, to tell one's own story, to celebrate, to express joy. And it's not written for the bucks. And people are writing for the dollars. It doesn't resonate in the same way. It can entertain you, but not with the intention of sincerity, but the intention of ultimately making money for you. It's suspect. It's tainted by the dollar. Not the root of all evil. It's the root of a lot of what's going on now, of course. But here's the answer to your very important question. It is essential to revitalize this writing of songs of conscience, which is a tradition that emanated from folk music. And indeed, I've been keenly aware of that and doing many things that I could over the years to try to continue to champion that. I created 4 children's books. Each one of them had 12 songs. Now, they've gone out of print, and I have to resurrect that, and I will. But I've done that, but much more importantly, it came to me that what could really jumpstart this effort is possible. Now, the problem is these songs are getting written all the time, but you don't hear them because mm-hmm. we don't have the popular radio and other ways of exposing them devoted to that, because it's not a big money maker, and the music business has become so commodified that it's really focused on maximizing this quarter's earnings. You know, mm-hmm. it's just, and you're not going to make as much money on these kinds of songs, and it's going to cost you a lot to develop a new the career and believe in the career of Bob Dylan or Phil Oakes or any of those people. Now, how do we get around that? Well, the force for a lot of what's gone wrong in the world, which is the internet, there are many reasons the internet is problematical. And one of them is people are continually brutalized by going to the vitriol that constantly is being fed on the internet, on Facebook and Twitter and whatever else. You're going to an office or a classroom where there's going to be anger and animosity and cruelty. It's going to affect you. So it's going to normalize that. That's really bad. But there's a positive possibility, because it occurred to me that if we could get certain songs of conscience to be viral, they could become very well known.
Yes.
And that I've put the falling into play. I was asked to write an anthem for the Parkland students for a variety of reasons,
sure.
And I declined. And I said instead what I wanted to do, come down with a dozen songwriters like myself who think of their music mainly as being a vehicle for a sharing ethic that brings people together and asserts commonality and stands up for the things that we want and mm-hmm. and shares the good things in life that come to us, like being there for each other and standing up for the things we care about, etc.
Mm-hmm.
And I went down with these songwriters not to write songs for the students, but to have them write songs and mentor them in it. And we did that. These are kids, many of whom had seen their friends shot in front of them. There were about 35 of them. We split into four groups, and between 4 o'clock and 11 o'clock at night for 2 nights, we wrote songs. 2 hours we'd have, and then we'd get together again, hear what we had. We wrote 13 songs, 10 of which are now on an album, and they are unbelievable. And I'm in the process of making videos. We made the first one, and it's the kind of thing that could break through this dense fog. It's a sensibility that's so powerful. We don't want these kids to die. We've got 230,000 some kids that have been in schools where there's been a school shooting.
Mm-hmm.
And they're traumatized for life.
I'm so intrigued by the fact there is an album that exists.
Okay, well, it's not out yet. We're right now negotiating with a record company to put it out.
Okay.
It's a little tricky because they feel obligated to do this work for free, but they can't take on the costs of doing it. So we've got to figure out how to do that, but I think we'll have it resolved. One video done, 2 more are now in the works, and I plan to have videos made for all 10 songs.
I revisited the story of you and Mary meeting in her apartment. It brought out McDougal Street. I read Dave Van Ronk's book about McDougal Street, and what a wonderful time and place. You decided to approach Noel, who Mary knew at the time. You went to the place that he shared with Tom Paxton, and then sang Mary Had a Little Lamb as an audition. I thought that was, you know, stories about that kind of synergy don't get much better than that. All of that stuff is in the book, and I urge people to get a copy. This is going to sit on my coffee table. In fact, I guess I got to go out and buy a coffee table. I don't have one. Because this book needs a coffee table. So now we've looked back, and people will continue to look back and think of Peter, Paul, and Mary every time they hear the name Peter Yarrow, who we're on the phone with, by the way, coming to the West Denmark Lutheran Church. That is in Luck, Wisconsin. It's a beautiful, beautiful venue. And he's going to be with son Christopher. It's Saturday, July 27th, 7:30 p.m.
You know what happened, though? They sold it out, and we're going to be doing another concert the next day.
Cool.
At 2:30, a matinee. And they said, can we do another one? And we decided, yes, yes, yes.
Good.
And that was just formalized just about, you know, an hour ago. So that's the second show.
Let me ask you this, just brief answers on these, because I want to catch up. Operation Respect, I went to the website. I still see you and Noel as board members. That continues?
Of course.
Okay.
I ran it for 20 years, but okay. This project with the Parkland students is part of it, the sponsors and the overseers of it. And there's another huge project we're doing, which is bringing Republicans and Democrats, blues and reds, together called Better Angels. It's not our program, but it's a huge effort, and it's to depolarize America, because when we're polarized, as I was saying before, we're vulnerable. So we can't hate each other. We don't need to. That's what these workshops show, that we really are not divided in the way that we've been told.
We've looked back. Now let's look ahead. You appear on stage, and will do so, with your son Christopher. And I also watched a video of you performing a marvelous version of Sweet Survivor with daughter Bethany.
Oh, thank you.
So the Yarrow bloodline continues to flow. That's good news. You and I were talking about how we can continue and bring back the stuff that matters. The last time you and I talked, boarding the train, to use the analogy that you and I used about passing things on.
Right, yes, yes.
Do you think young and future generations care enough to make a difference? Have we passed it on? Let's talk about the Parkland students, because you spent time with them. They are obviously activists as it pertains to their small world, which got very big the day that their lives changed. Will they continue like Peter Yarrow has for so many years?
Well, I think the answer is probably some will and some won't. But the important thing is, it is the youth that are leading the charge today. The Swedish 15-year-old Greta Thunberg sat outside and demonstrated outside Parliament. And now she's been all over the world. And because of her, there was the international school walkout for climate change. She's 15 years old, and these kids are all over. And they are listened to much differently and much more seriously in many ways than adults. We all cherish the youth. We don't put them in the same category. And we also believe them because they're more innocent and they're more forthright. So when you see these kids on television, and you'll see, of course, Emma Gonzalez and David Hogue and many others. But when you see the kids that are singing, you will combine music, which really gets through in a certain way, with an appeal that says, I'm pleading for my life and the life of my friends and the children that come after me. And you've got to be a person lost without empathy, without compassion, not to respond to that in a way of saying, we don't want this. So it's the women and the young people. Mm-hmm. And the young people have inherited this legacy. I don't know the degree to which folk music itself has precipitated their continuing of that legacy. But I do know the fact of its existence and the fact of songs now being made. And by the way, I had a benefit for the Parkland Kids effort in Operation Respect. And my granddaughter, who's 12, brought along some of the climate kids whom she joins every Friday at the UN, and they demonstrate. Huh. And she says, I shouldn't have to miss school to make this happen.
No.
But I have to. So, yes, it's really the younger group that has somehow gotten mobilized, and the women who have been so offended are leading the charge. It's the time of women, and we need the kind of sensibilities that women carry to take much more of the leadership role, at least as much as men.
Amen.
I really believe that. Pragmatically, that's what's going to save us.
I love to hear you talk, and I could do it forever. But I want to let people know, when they come to see Peter Yarrow sing, it is a joyful occasion. We have talked about some serious things because it's important. Peter Yarrow, it's always a pleasure. You are one of America's best. Peter Yarrow will not be around forever.
That's true. We need him while he's here to do what he's doing.
And we need to all get on the train.
Board the train and sing your songs and leave your legacy of goodness when it's time to detrain.
Thank you. Okay. Travel safely.
You got it, my brother. Bye-bye.
I'm leaving on a jet plane. I don't know when I'll be back again. Oh, babe, I hate to go.
I dig rock and roll music and I love to get the chance to play
and sing it.
I figure it's about the happiest sound going down today.
That's what you get for loving me. That's what you get for loving me. Everything you had is gone, as you can see. Stubal was a racehorse, and I wish he were mine. He never drank water, he always drank wine.
Lord, I'm 500 miles from my home.
ago. Peter Yarrow, who tells me that the second half of his shows are dedicated to the songs you want to hear. By the way, the added show is at 2:30 p.m. Sunday, the 28th. Go to westdenmark.net, click on the concerts link for tickets. Here's what I imagine. People are going to just have this feeling, and they're going to jump in their cars and head towards Luck, Wisconsin, late Sunday morning, early Sunday afternoon, and they're going to end up at the West Denmark Lutheran Church, not knowing why. Kind of a Woodstocky thing. Good for you.